Okay. Well, thank you. Pleasure. It's a pleasure to discuss these topics with you. They're not easy things to talk about, but they're very, very important. And I appreciate the opportunity to do so. And I really respect all of your, you know, decision to join this conversation because it is important. And it's unique what we're doing now to kind of build up. I think we'll talk more next week about the importance of having an advanced directive and especially the one that we have designed. But we're doing more than that. We're really preparing for that conversation in a real, I think, sophisticated and intentional way. And so really much respect to all of you for engaging in that conversation. And last week, what we did was kind of just talk about general principles. And we talked about how there are some who have this perspective that life is of infinite value and everything has to be done at all costs, no matter what. And then we saw this perspective that I argue and I believe is the more kind of mainstream approach within rabbinic thinkers that, yes, of course, life is of incredible value. Absolutely. But to say infinite value might not be accurate. It might be more accurate to say life is of relative value, relative to pain and suffering. We want to do everything we can to prolong life, but we do not want to prolong suffering, prolong the dying process. People are not expected to have to undergo extreme suffering and pain in the face of terminal illness. There does come a point when we are allowed to accept the reality that everyone dies and that they should be allowed to do so in a way that's as comfortable as possible and that they have some control and say over how that happens for them. And so what I want to do today, after having kind of just shared with you some of the sources and this overall kind of perspective and theory, is to now this week go into some practical questions, which we'll do on a much more personal basis next week. We'll really have a chance for you to talk about it and to think about you, yourself, your own life, your families. But today, let's start just talking about some examples. I've been a chaplain for a number of years now, and just from like my experience, what are the questions that come up in hospitals and in people's lives most frequently? And I just want to share with you kind of like a sampling of the most common topics and questions and share with you some approaches from within the Jewish tradition to consider and also to hear your questions and comments about that. And then that will really prepare us for next week because many of those questions will come up again next week as we fill out our own advanced directive. I'll send it out in advance or you'll have it there on the screen and just make, you know, have a pen or pencil with you and we'll just we'll discuss it more specifically. But today let's just start talking about these questions. So what are the questions that come up? Especially for everyone, but in particular with an eye on Jewish populations, what are some of the issues? And I'll tell you the first one. The order I'm doing it is what I think makes sense because I think one issue will flow to the next issue. So it's not necessarily ranked in terms of, you know, importance or frequency, although this probably is the most frequent issue that comes up in my experience, which is the issue of ventilators. When is it appropriate to go on a ventilator? When is it appropriate to turn off a ventilator, respirator? We call this in, you know, medical language, intubation, to put one onto a respirator, and extubation. And just very, very briefly, just because, you know, everyone has different medical background, the idea of a ventilator is it was developed and really, really came into the common usage in, you know, in the past 50, 60 years. The idea is that Our brain, and we're going to talk about this later in depth, our brain stem in particular controls our breathing, right? You don't have to think to yourself to breathe. You can think to yourself to breathe, right? You can make a decision to take a deep breath, and actually oftentimes that's a very good thing to do. But without thinking, obviously we all know that our brains will control our respiration, our breathing. On the other hand, our heart is not controlled by our brain in the same way. Yes, of course, there are ways in which our brain interacts with our heart, but in many ways, a heart can beat without a brain. You can actually YouTube this, and my own hospital is now doing heart transplants for people from Hawaii, and that's a long flight. How do they keep the hearts fresh all the way from Hawaii? And the answer is they keep the hearts beating in the plane from Hawaii to LA. So a heart can beat on its own. It has its own internal pacemaker, so to speak. It can beat even without the heart, without the brain initiating those beats. Now, in all of human history, the brain and the heart, it's been, yes.
Do you mean the heart that's going to be transplanted?
Yeah.
That's not in the body.
Right. But even technically, a heart in a body technically can beat for some time without the brain telling it to beat. Here's the issue. We have a whole, it's a whole system, right? Our brain is telling our lungs to breathe. By our lungs breathing, it enables our heart to have oxygenated blood, and therefore our heart can beat. By our heart making blood flow, it enables our brains to work. It's a whole system that's working together. Our brain, our lungs, our heart. So throughout human history, if there would be a reason by which our brain was not telling our lungs to breathe, a person will die, right? Whether it's hypothermia or a drug overdose or, God forbid, a trauma where they were had horrible force to their brain, some kind of an accident. So if their brain's not functioning, then their lungs won't function, and then their heart won't function, then they would die. However, when the respirator was invented, that overrode the system. And a person can be put on a ventilator, and therefore, even if their brain is not initiating breaths, theoretically, a ventilator can do the job for them and keep their lungs breathing without the brain telling it to breathe, and therefore keep the heart beating, and therefore the heart's keeping the body alive, such that even without brain initiating the decision to breathe, a person can be kept alive. The respirator, in addition to doing that, so sometimes it's just a brief period of time when a person's brain's not functioning. Like I gave the example of hypothermia or a drug overdose, where a person's brain can recover. Or I gave the example last week where a person had a horrible brain aneurysm, a brain bleed that did recede for that person, thankfully. So there could be times when a brain is not working and a respirator will save their life because it just keeps them alive through that acute event. And then after, whether it's a few days or weeks or sometimes even more, they can then recover. And then in those cases, we call the respirator a bridge because it was a bridge through that horrible valley, so to speak, through that horrible acute event. The respirator also enables surgery in many ways because now that we thankfully can use sophisticated pain medications, right? Anesthesia, sometimes that could suppress respiration. A person could be at risk of not breathing in surgery because they're not feeling, thankfully, the surgery. So we have them intubated, we have them on a respirator, keeping them breathing in spite of the fact that these medications might suppress the drive to breathe because it's controlling the pain. So that's also a great thing. That also enabled organ donation, as we'll talk about, right? Because you can keep a body alive, and we'll talk about this more in depth. So it enabled surgeries, organ donation, and saving lives. Respirators are amazing things. There's also risk involved because, as I referred to it before, as a bridge, right? It's a bridge from one acute event to survival, and that's a great thing about respirators. It can also be what we call in medical language a destination, meaning that's it. There's nowhere to go from there. Sometimes someone goes on a respirator, and oftentimes it's the right thing to do. If you're in an emergency room, an ambulance, you don't know what to do. The first responders don't know what to do, so they'll intubate someone, and they'll do the test and just to save their life. And then they don't know, and then they'll find out after they run all the tests to see, is their brain function? Is there something that they can recover from? So it's oftentimes the right thing to do, to decide to intubate someone. But then what do you do, and this is the big question, once you realize that this person has no chance of recovery? It's not a bridge, it's a destination. And they could be stuck on a ventilator. What we do in the hospitals is that the ventilator, we call it an endotracheal tube. Or for short, an ET tube. They put the tube into the mouth, down the trachea, and into the lungs. But that can't stay forever because that causes, you know, breakdown of the trachea and can lead to infections. So after about 2 weeks, they'll start to say, you know what, if you want to keep this tube in there, we have to put in a tracheotomy, and where they go directly into the trachea through the neck instead of going through the mouth. And that's more permanent. Obviously has some risks involved and obviously not ideal for everyone, but that often becomes the next choice. But what does one do when they are now in that situation where they have the respirator and they can't get off of it? First of all, the decision to go on the respirator, what we say, what the rabbis say, the rabbis that I consult with, as well as medical professionals, we say is, when the question is to go on it, you know, you will have many rabbis who will tell people, you have to be careful about going on it because once you go on, you can never come off. The risk of that is that what if someone does recover, you know, and it would be good for them. Do we want to not go on the respirator because of the concern that we can't take the person off the respirator when it could save their life, right? As I've described all the medical background. So what we say is, And I'm talking we as rabbis, but also doctors say the same thing. This is not a contradiction here, and I will share with you some points of disagreement, is a patient should be intubated if there is a chance that they will be extubated. A patient should go on the respirator if there's a chance that they will be able to come off the respirator. If the doctors think, and sometimes this happens, that there's no chance of coming off of it once they go on, then we say they are not obligated to go on the respirator. That goes back to last week's discussion about life being of relative value. You do not have to do everything possible at all times if it will only lead to causing prolonged suffering that will just prolong the dying process. So in those cases, we say do not go on the respirator. But what I'm talking about here is a different scenario. The patient's on the respirator now. They went on it for the right reason, right? As we discussed, they thought this would save their life, but unfortunately, they did not improve. And now the doctors are saying, if you take them off the respirator, they will die right away as a result. So this becomes a moral, ethical, rabbinic dilemma, because if my action is going to lead to their immediate demise, meaning my action of extubation, of removing the respirator, there are some who feel that this is causing the death, not allowing the death. This all goes back to the source we saw last week about the woodchopper. If you remember, we saw that a person who's dying, if they're dying for a long time, we said you cannot move their body or move the pillow from underneath their head to make them die quicker. But you could, if there's a woodchopper chopping wood and that is prolonging their death, or there's salt on the tongue, you could remove the salt on the tongue or stop the woodchopper from chopping wood. So which is the respirator? Is the respirator the pillow under their head, or is it the wood chopper or the salt on the tongue? And I'm sure everyone, you know, might have different opinions about that. There were rabbis who said it's the wood chopper, and therefore you could turn it off. Most rabbis, and this is what most people have heard, many, many, many rabbis said it's more like the pillow under the head. It's more direct. It's inside their body. It's moving the patient, and therefore removing the respirator, if the patient will die right away as a result, is considered like killing them. So what do we do? What do we do in these cases? It is a challenge because sometimes we say we can't. So now when people ask me, they say, Rabbi, on the one hand, we want to put our mother or father or brother, whatever, whoever, on the respirator. But we're nervous because we've heard rumors that rabbis will say, once you're on it, if you're vent dependent, that's the medical word, meaning it's breathing for you. And if it's taken off, the patient will die right away. We've been told that we can't take them off. We are not allowed by Jewish law. So we don't want to put them on. But the doctors are saying there is some chance that the life could be saved if they go on it. So what should we do? So often I'll tell them, if the doctors don't think there's a chance of coming off of it, like I said before, don't go on it. But if they think that there's a chance that this could save their life, I always say, let's take that chance and I will guide you through what Jewish law says that there are ways of getting them off. First of all, in Jewish law, we often say, and this is based, again, on that woodchopper story, we say that we are allowed to withhold interventions, even if we shouldn't withdraw life-sustaining interventions. So not putting in the respirator to begin with, that's withholding, not withdrawing. What are other examples? Well, many rabbis say, first of all, if a patient won't die right away, if they can be optimized by the medical team, and they seem to be initiating some breaths on their own, such that they can live at least for a number of hours to a number of days, ideally a minimum. Some rabbis say it has to be a number of days, but other great rabbis have told me that actually it's just a number of hours at least. Then they can be extubated, as long as we don't think they're going to die right away as a result. That's one option. Another option is that we say that sometimes the patient can be weaned from the respirator. We do this very carefully, and we say that we can turn down the respirator is doing a few things. It's giving oxygenated air, and it's also pumping air. So we say, turn the oxygen down to just, you know, the room normal, 21%, and the pumps can go to the lowest level that the patient needs to stay alive. Keep it at the lowest setting. And then either if they need it to go up further, we don't have to turn it up, or if we can keep turning it down such that they're stable, each time we turn it down a little bit more, they stay stable, then if we keep it to the point where it's not doing anything, then we can take it off. That's another option. Another option sometimes is that the rabbis will say, well, you can allow, sometimes there's blood pressure medication. Remember the whole medical lesson I started with today of how, you know, goes brain, lungs, heart, heart, brain, lungs, that whole system. Well, since the brain is now somewhat connected from the lungs and the heart and the respirator is taking the place, sometimes blood pressure suffers as a result as well, because the brain often controls blood pressure. So in place of that, pressors, vasopressors is the medical term, is provided to keep the blood pressure up, especially when the brain's not functioning. So it's the respirator and the vasopressors. The pressors, the rabbis say, if we can withhold and not withdraw, so we say, you know what, the pressors are coming, they're in a bag, in an IV. You're allowed to let the bag run out, and if we're talking about a patient who's terminal in the dying process and suffering, right, you can let it run out and allow them to die naturally instead of removing the respirator. That's another option. And by the way, this removing the respirator, it's not just about Jewish law. Many bioethicists argue, oh, there's no difference really, when you come down to it, between withholding and withdrawing. They disagree with us. But then many practitioners argue, if you argue philosophically, withholding and withdrawing is not different, but experientially it is. And that was why during COVID, for example, when nurses were being asked to withdraw patients from the ventilator who were anyways sick and elderly and dying to make way for patients who had a chance of survival, the nurses didn't want to do it because they said, it goes against my ethics to extubate someone not for their own good. Meaning if they wanted it, that's one thing. But if we're doing it just because we're being told that someone else needs their respirator more, it feels like killing them. And so they didn't want to do it. So you can see why this rabbinic perspective, it does make a lot of sense. And experientially, there is something to be said for that. So that's one. There's one more option. Then, Allison, I'd love to hear your question. One other approach, just to mention the other approaches rabbis have given, that's been suggested but has not been implemented, is there was a suggestion that to put the respirator on a timer. They are trying this at Shari Tzedek. They just haven't implemented it yet because they haven't gotten IRB approval, which you can imagine is not easy to get approval to research this on human beings. But they want to put the idea is when you put a patient on a respirator, have it with a timer that will automatically go off for 24 hours. But in 23 hours, you can decide to extend it for another 24 hours and constantly do that. Or you can say, you know what, they're not surviving and they're suffering, so just let it run out. That was the theory among some of the rabbis. So those are some approaches that some rabbis have taken to enable people to be withdrawn from a respirator, even though we normally only withhold and not withdraw, but there's ways of doing it. But that's one major issue that comes up a lot. Questions?
Can survive. If you have an advanced directive and it is respected, is there halachic justification for refusing to go on a ventilator despite the physician's comments?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So first of all, you know, we don't force people. You know, people have the right to make decisions about their own healthcare, and we're not going to force them. Typically, what the rabbis say is, you know, Lev Yodea Maris Nafsho. You know, people, the Torah says, you know, people know their own suffering. If someone says they are suffering, obviously we respect their own experience. If the way the rabbis break it down, basically, and this is relevant for what we're going to talk about in a minute, we sometimes categorize patients into those who are terminal and those who are not terminal. So terminal, we say, is that they have less than a year to live. That's called chayei shah. Some rabbis say it's less than 6 months to live, same as American law. Some say, no, anything more than that, that's not terminal. Many rabbis say if an intervention will only keep someone within that terminal phase, meaning let's say someone has 2 months to live, and they do an intervention that could give them, you know, now they'll have 5 months to live. The rabbis say, you know what, you're not required to undergo pain and suffering for those extra 3 months if it's all within the terminal phase. Whereas they argue, if someone has 2 months to live, but a certain intervention will give them another 5 years or 10 years, then the rabbis say, you know what, that Jewish law expects you to go through. The person can make an argument, you know, about their suffering, definitely, and we are going to talk about physician aid in dying soon, as it's legal here in California, where we all are. A choice for someone to end their life passively, meaning by not undergoing that intervention, is definitely better halachically, morally, ethically, in most perspectives, than to actively do something to cause their death. So, you know, obviously we would want to examine why they're making that choice, and we don't make these decisions willy-nilly. We just say, like, you know, I'm upset because the Giants lost. I'm sorry, I'm from LA, so it's the Giants lost the World Series, whatever it is. I don't know. So you know, obviously we want to understand the reasoning, but there's more justification for passively allowing and saying I just don't want to undergo that than to say I want to actively do something to end it. But otherwise, we would obviously encourage the intubation if it's expected to be something that will very likely save someone's life in the long term. That's a good question. Thank you for asking that. This actually leads to, you know, we've been kind of dancing around it. Another major issue that is actually a major debate and was a huge controversy in the rabbinic world for many years and still to some extent. And that is the issue of the definition of death. Because I've been using phrases like terminal and dying process. But what does it even mean to be dead? How do you define death? And this is an important conversation to bring up, by the way, because, you know, and I appreciate that you know, many of you are medical practitioners, and I myself, you know, work in a hospital and definitely respect the medical profession. But because when it comes to the definition of death, it's not totally a medical issue, obviously, right? Because we all experience it. It's a philosophical, religious, spiritual issue for someone for whom they live. Look at things from a religious perspective. I mean, how do you define life? How do you define death is a religious issue. How you determine, right, the criteria for determining death, obviously that's medical. But the definition itself, what does it mean to be dead? That is very much the purview of religion. So how can we define death? I mean, we were discussing a minute ago, you know, respirators and all the medical background for that and why that became relevant. How could we expect our tradition to be able to have sources to guide us in this when this is such a modern dilemma? Because, right, as I described before, like the whole issue of the brain controlling the lungs but not the heart, but then the lungs controlling the heart and all that, like, In the past, you didn't have the respirator to keep someone alive to bypass that system. So obviously someone would just, what did it mean to define death? So there is a source. And actually today I don't plan on reading sources with you so much, but I just want to show you one source. And then we'll just discuss a couple more issues and then take some questions. But I'll show you one source because there is a fascinating source that does help us define death. And it's relevant for the conversation. So here's the source. It's in the Talmud. In Yoma, Pei Hei Amud Aleph. That means page 85a. It says as follows, just one short paragraph. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught. Let's say a building collapses on someone on the Sabbath, and we want to know if they're alive because we can only dig up the rubble if they're alive on the Sabbath. So how far do we have to examine their body to determine if they're alive and therefore to be allowed to violate the Sabbath to save their lives? So it's Ad Heichanu Bodek, until we're in the body, do you check? So it says, ad chotmo, until their nose. V'yesh omrim ad libo, but some say no, until their heart. Some say you have to feel their heart. Some say you have to feel their nose to determine if they're alive. So the rabbi said, badak umatza yoni mesim. Let's say you're digging through the rubble and you find the people on top that are already dead. Lo yomar kavar mesim ha tachtonim. You don't therefore say, oh, if the people on the top are dead, the people on the bottom must be dead already. No, you don't give up. You keep searching. Because Maisa Shaya, there was once a case. Umatzo Yoni Mesim, they found the people on top were dead. V'tachtonim Chaim, the people on the bottom were alive, so they kept checking. So that's point number one, is that some say check the nose, some say check the heart. Okay, let's go one step further. Name Mahani Tanai Kahani Tanai. Let's say that this debate about where you check to determine death is the same as a debate of where a baby, a fetus, becomes alive. The rabbi said, Tanya, V'heichan Havlad Notzar, where does a fetus form from? Meaning what part of the body? They believe that it started from one spot and then it formed outwards from that spot. So some rabbi said, Mirosho, starts from a head and then the body comes out of the head. Shenemar, because it says, Mimai imi ata gozi, because you pulled me from my mother's womb, v'omer, and it also says, gozi nizircha v'shlichi, and gozi also refers to the head. But Abba Shaul Omer, but another rabbi said, no, a fetus doesn't start out from its head. It starts out, mi tiburo, from its belly button. Umishalach sharshav elach elach. And then from its belly button, it expands, you know, legs, arms, and head. So that's another same disagreement. Do you check to the nose or to the heart? And by the way, some of the rabbis even said, when it comes to death also, it wasn't into your heart, it's to your belly. Your tiburo means your belly. Diaphragm. Then they concluded, Afilu teim Abba Shaul, even if you'll say the Abba Shaul, Arkan lo ka'amar Abba Shaul hasam, they didn't say this, Ela le'inyin yitzir, that was only about where you're formed from, where you're born. T'chomi did the mitziate mitzre, because that, you know, is everything is formed from its source. Aval inyin b'kuach nefesh, when it comes to saving a life, even he who said you're formed from your belly, Afilu Abba Shaul modi, t'ikr chiyusa ba'apehu, that the main source of life is in your nose. How do we know that? Because the Torah said, "Dichsiv kol asher nishmat ruach chayim ba'apav," all that which a source of life is in your nose. The breath of life, your soul, comes through your breath, through your nose. Amar of Papa machlokas mimata lamad. This they only even disagreed when you're checking from the bottom, like from the feet up. Of all mimala lamata, but when you're checking from the bottom down, meaning from the head down, and you get to the nose, given the buttock layad chotmo shuvenu tarich. That's it. You're done because it says. The rabbis clearly concluded that the main way we define life is from breath, from the nose, from the nostrils, from breathing. That's the definition of life and death. Now, you might say from that, based on the little biology lesson I gave you at the start of our discussion today, that that is very clear about how we define death, which is breathing. And what controls breathing? Our brain. Right? Our brainstem, to be precise. Because all we care about is the breathing. However, Rashi and many of the commentaries say, no, that was just because they didn't know how to check very well. So that was just the most reliable sign was checking the breathing. But what we really cared about is the heartbeat. And so if the heart's beating, the person is alive, and that's the main thing. The heartbeat is the actual determination. The criteria to test it is the nose. So that's why this became a huge debate amongst the rabbis. And it was a big debate in America as well when organ donation became possible in the 60s, because we have a rule throughout the world called the dead donor rule, DDR, which is that you can't kill someone for their organs, because obviously that would be unethical. Problem is, many organs you can't transplant unless you take them from a person, right? You need them right away. So let's say you want to transplant a heart, which saves many, many lives, right? Heart transplants is amazing technology. But how, if the heartbeat is a definition of life and death, how can you get a heart out of someone to give it to someone else if that will, by definition, be killing the person because you're cutting it out of their chest while it's still beating? So it became popularized in the 1960s, and especially in the 80s in particular with what was called the Harvard Criteria, that they said, you know what, we can define death by brainstem, right? Brain death. Because if they're on a respirator, they would have died anyways, but the respirator kept them alive because the brain isn't working. Therefore, we can say that someone, even with a heartbeat, is dead, and therefore we can proceed with organ donation. The rabbis debated this. Many, many rabbis said, nope, if the heart's beating, they're alive. But other great rabbis, including the chief rabbinate of Israel, said, we're convinced by the argument that the brain is what controls respiration. That's what the rabbis were looking for, and therefore that's what's considered life and death. And therefore, organ donation, including heart transplantation, can proceed. Which leads us to the next issue I want to bring up, and this is going to be on the advanced directives as we discuss, which is organ donation. What about that? Is that allowed by Judaism? When I ask this question to groups, and I say, does Judaism allow organ donation? Yes or no? The majority in Jewish groups, from my experience, this is just anecdotal, say, nope, it's not allowed. Do you all agree with that? Judaism does not allow organ donation? No, good. It does allow organ donation. But what's important is to categorize it into there's three types of organ donation. This is important to be aware of. And this is why I think where some of the misconceptions come from. There is posthumous organ donation, which we just talked about, which does require accepting the definition of death as brain death, because otherwise you're killing a person. But if you accept that definition, which many rabbis do, then you can say, well, it's to save a life. It's the greatest mitzvah. It's allowed. Then there is what we call that's sort of a gray area, because also there is, yes, thank you, Rabbi Cohen. So then there's also, that's really perimortem organ donation, right? Because that's right before and after, right, around the time of death. Then posthumous organ donation is really after someone's a corpse. Once they're a corpse, and you can't take as much, but you can still take skin, corneas, bone, some organs that last a little bit longer, tissues. Is that allowed? Many people argue, no, Judaism can't allow that because we have to bury right away. You're not allowed. You must treat the body with extreme caution. They think that, you know, autopsies are not allowed, which oftentimes autopsies are not allowed by Jewish law. That's true. But if it can save a life of a specific person whose life it can save, then we do allow autopsies. And for that same reason, since we're saving a life and we're not, this is not being done to mutilate the body, but to actually help other people, in those cases, it is allowed. Now, you might have heard of some controversies here in California where bodies were taken by organ procurement organizations in order, not with necessarily the informed consent of the families and not in with what they expected, only for the sake of cosmetic surgeries and selling parts of their bodies that could be used for cosmetic surgeries like fat and skin. And that's a different conversation, right? That might not be such a big mitzvah. Maybe it's there's advantages of it, but there's a definitely negative side to it. So it's important to be aware, and we'll talk about this more next week, but it is important to be aware. And that is one reason why we often encourage people, instead of putting on their driver's license that they're an organ donor, to put it on their advance directive, to therefore allow their family and their rabbi to be involved in the process so they can ensure that the organ's being donated properly to save lives. Then there's living organ donation. That is what, I wasn't going to mention it, but yes, that's what you mentioned there that I did 8 months ago when I donated a kidney. Is that allowed? Well, I guess I gave it away. Actually, just, it's funny, I teach a class in a local high school, and when I donated my kidney, there was an article about it in the local Jewish paper, and I did what I just told you I do. I said, raise your hands. Does Judaism allow organ donation? And like half the class raised their hand. No, it doesn't. Then one of the kids in the class said, wait a second, didn't a rabbi in LA just donate his kidney? And then one of the other kids in the class was like, yeah, wait, wasn't it you? So it gave away. So now I couldn't do my my poll anymore, ruined my polling. It's now biased. But so I can't just ask you, but does Judaism allow living organ donation? And obviously, what this all comes down to is there is a source for it. What's the source in the Torah? How can we have a source of organ donation? It only became possible in the 60s and 70s. So there was a great authority called the Radvaz. He was the chief rabbi of Egypt in the 15th century. And he was once asked the following question. A Jew was taken hostage. Unfortunately, a timely question. Jew was taken hostage. But as a joke, just because they like making fun of Jews and just belittling Jews and harming Jews. And the Sultan, who took the Jew in Egypt, said to the Jewish community, hey, I know you Jews stick together and like each other and, you know, you're one community. We have one of your Jews here. We kidnapped him. We are willing to give him back to you if one of you will let us chop off your arm. Your arm for his life. Will any of you Jews come forward and let us chop off your arm to save your fellow Jew? That was the question he asked. And this question made it to this rabbi. Actually made it to a lot of rabbis. The Radvaz's answer is especially instructive. He said, it depends. Depends on the risk. If you're in a situation where chopping off your arm to save someone else's life will likely, possibly, leading towards likely, kill you, you're not required. In fact, maybe prohibited to give your life for someone else's life. That was what he calls it, a pious fool, a chassid shota. You don't have to give your life to save someone else's life. Chayecha kodmi, another principle we have in halacha, your life can come first. But if it's not so risky, it's not. Then you have the permission. You don't have to do it, because that's a big thing to ask, to give your arm for someone's life. But you can do it. Then he argued, if it would be very minimal risk, like not your arm, but let's say like, I don't know, drawing blood, then it would not only be permissible, it might even be required. In other words, if you were to draw a chart, it's like the more beneficial an act comes and is, and the less risky it becomes, the more it's required. So if something's very risky, but even if it's very beneficial, it's not going to be required. But as it becomes less and less risky, especially when it's more and more beneficial, it becomes more and more encouraged. So for example, kidney donation, we would not say it's an obligation. You know, there's a lot of people, there's like 96,000 people in America right now waiting for a kidney. It would be a great mitzvah to save their life. But we would not say to someone, you're required to do it. Especially different people have different risk profiles and whatnot. But let's say it was something less risky. You would say you can do it. And if you do it, it's a great mitzvah. But let's say it's something like bone marrow donation. And someone needs that bone marrow donation to save their life, but they're having trouble finding someone. And you're a match for them. And that's not so risky to donate bone marrow, right? Especially unless someone has some kind of certain risk factor. But in general, it's not so risky. So then we might say, actually, it's required by Jewish law to donate bone marrow to save a life. Or let's say something like a blood donation, right? Things that are not so risky, but if they can do a lot of good, they become more and more obligatory. So anyways, we now see how this whole discussion of brain death and organ donation, withholding, withdrawing, it all is related and connected. And I just want to mention one other issue, and then I want to hear your questions and thoughts. Because and you'll see next week why this is all relevant. Because next week, you're going to have the option, actually, on your advanced directive to actually decide, do you want to donate organs or not? And you will also see, by the way, that we worded it very carefully, and you'll understand why. Because we worded it, if a person has died based on the criteria that their rabbi accepts, meaning we didn't say brain death or not brain death, we said if they are dead based on whatever criteria their rabbi agrees to, would they want to donate organs? So we didn't get into that whole debate, because many rabbis said, no, if you don't accept brain death, then even asking the question is problematic. But we wrote this document to allow all perspectives, and you'll have that choice. So it's something to think about. Would you want posthumously to allow your organs to be donated or not? And if so, are there specific ones you would want and specific ones you would not want to be donated? So this leads to one last area that is another very common. In fact, I've only had the pleasure, if you could put it that way, of being an expert witness in my career twice. It's always interesting. But the first time was for this question, and it comes up a lot in the hospitals. And it will be an issue that we'll discuss in our advanced directives next week. And that is the issue of truth-telling. How honest must we be with patients in the hospital when we find out, God forbid, that someone has a serious diagnosis, or that their diagnosis is worse than they thought, or their prognosis is worse than they thought, or what it is, or the specifics? Do we have to tell everyone, every patient, every detail of it? Should we withhold that information? There definitely was a time, and we can actually see it changed in the 60s and 70s when there was a very paternalistic approach to healthcare in America, when patients were not told this information. And now the pendulum might have swung to the opposite extreme, where people are told a lot of information, maybe even more than they need to know. Truth obviously is important, right? We don't want people to be liars. That's not a good thing. And truth is essential in a court of law, right? Or in situations in which falsehood could cause monetary damage, for example. But sometimes how much truth should be divulged is a very sensitive ethical question, right? Sometimes we don't need to tell everyone everything. And this has a long history within the Jewish tradition, right? In fact, we just read about it in last week's Parsha, right? Sarah, when Sarah dies, she dies in the Torah right after the binding of Isaac. Now, even though Isaac was not sacrificed by his father, Rashi tells us that she was told that he was almost sacrificed, and that news caused her to die of shock. So we see from that there is such a thing where someone could die from bad news. And we know of this, right? We know of cases, right? We've all heard of there's been cases where people went into shock. I mean, Rabbi Levi Meir, of blessed memory, my predecessor at Cedar Sinai, I heard him tell the story. It's actually recorded on YU Torah. You can hear his weekly Parsha lectures. He told the story of a psychologist here at the hospital who was very sophisticated. He came into the hospital for a number of tests. He knew things weren't going well, but he didn't know what it was. And he told them, I want you to tell me the whole truth. And Rabbi Meir was with them. He says, they said to him, you know what? We'll give you some information. Yeah, you know, it's serious, but we have some ideas, some plans. Well, let's work on it. He says, no. I want to know everything. He said, yeah, it is serious, but we're going to know more as we go. He says, no, you're not telling me everything. Tell me everything. I can handle it. I'm a psychologist. So they told him, actually, we're sorry to tell you, but it's a very serious tumor, and the odds are that you won't survive for very long, and we're going to do everything we can for you. And Rabbi Meir says he went into a horrific depression, and within 2 days, he died. And Rabbi Meir felt regret that they told him in such an honest and open and direct way. He felt they should have been more gentle, but he asked for it. But this is the question, you know, can we be honest and forthcoming? Do we want it? And also for ourselves, do we choose? I've had many experiences here in the hospital where there's a sign on the door before I walk in the room that someone in the patient's family has posted a sign on the door. Do not talk about the patient's diagnosis with them. Don't tell them what they have, you know, because they're trying to keep it from them. And that's their right. That's their choice. You know, obviously in hospitals, we believe in informed consent and autonomy and sharing information with patients, especially, you know, nowadays, as I'll explain. But there is, on the other hand, there is a value to, you know, what we call, there's something called the nocebo effect. You know, we have placebo effect. The nocebo effect is the concept that negative thoughts can harm one's health. And researchers have found that you know, negative health beliefs and expectations do lead to worsening symptoms. But on the other hand, we live in a world where when people are in the hospital, there are treatments and interventions that they're going through. And sometimes not telling them can make them fear that it's even worse than they thought it was, right? Or there might be decisions that have to be made, right? But do you want this radiation? Do you not want the radiation? Do you want the surgery? Or do you prefer chemo? You know, all kinds of questions that could come up. And if a patient doesn't know their own healthcare details, like how are they supposed to make those decisions? So, and medicine has a lot to offer. And so we often say that, you know, we should tell them information unless, you know, it's like they're in the dying process and like, what's the point of telling them? Sometimes it might make sense to withhold information. But in general, we encourage, you know, but it's like, how do you tell them? And when do you tell them? And what do you need to tell? Do you need to really tell everything? Because obviously we don't tell everything. So, but it's an important issue to think about. How much would you want to know? Both about what a person has and about how it's developing, what their prognosis is. And we'll discuss this more next week in terms of the, there's going to be some questions about that, but it's important to think about because there are many who feel that, and many traditional rabbinic sources that really argue that bad news can end someone's life. And sometimes, you know, there can be justification, you know, just like Abraham lied to the Egyptians about, you know, being Sarah's husband, and then God's self, you know, amidst Sarah's reference to Abraham being an old man when he reports Sarah's words to him, or Joseph's brothers falsely claiming that their father Jacob had commanded them to forgive them, right? There's all these cases where the rabbis, in the Torah, there are people who don't share the whole truth for the benefit of other people. So so it's something to think about. Is it right? Sometimes being told the whole truth before surgery, it can have negative impacts, right? One last point, and then I want to hear any comments, reactions you have. Just one last issue, and that is the issue of physician aid in dying. It's sometimes called by people who oppose it, they often call it physician-assisted suicide. By people who support it, they more likely call it medical aid in dying, something like that. It's legal here in California. It has been for 7 years now. It's a great thing, but even though we are 6 hours drive apart, we're in the same state, so we have the same laws, and I have a lot of experience with it now because we have had many people who have opted for that, and it's a complicated issue. I'm just mentioning it briefly, but then we'll open up for a conversation. Basically, Jewish law says that, you know, on the one hand, we do everything we can. As we said last week, we believe in prolonging life and supporting life and helping people to stay alive. And definitely Jewish law prohibits one from killing themselves and ending one's life in that way. At the same time, of course, we can have compassion for people who are suffering, for people who are terminally ill and contemplating these decisions. We know that, for example, Saul, King Shaul, killed himself in the Tanakh when the Plishtim were attacking, and he knew that he was going to be tortured by them, or what would happen as a result. Maybe it was, you know, as the king, it would have been especially problematic for the people to see them tortured as they would have done, or whatever might have happened. But he did. And even though the rabbi said that was prohibited by Jewish law, the rabbis offered sympathy for this and permit, you know, traditional burial and mourning practices and tried to show compassion for that decision. So, and also our rabbis, the tradition has been for thousands of years now to always assume that in almost every case of suicide, when someone ends their life in that way, it's not that a willful act of denial of, you know, their soul or resurrection, which is what it was assumed to be in the Talmudic times. But often there are mitigating circumstances such as fear, anguish, mental health struggles, you know, and it's not like they were doing it as an act of rebellion against the Torah, right? And so we often look for those mitigating circumstances and show compassion. And it's interesting that there are times when Jewish law, even if we say, you know, as I start out by saying that Jewish law prohibits medical aid in dying and ending one's life, there still can be times when Jewish law, for example, permits praying for someone who's suffering to die. There's many sources. We saw one last week about Rabbi Huda Nasi, that his assistant, the Amsa de Beit Rabbi, she prayed for him to die. And the rabbis then said that the commentary said that she did the right thing because he was suffering. So she prayed for him to die. And at the same time, the rabbinic authorities in our generation said that even when you're praying for someone to die, it would be permissible if you had to violate Shabbat to drive them to the emergency room. So there, you can hold two things in your mind at once and say, I hope this person is out of their suffering. And at the same time, I will do everything I can for them. So we can have this kind of split screen where we say, even if I disagree with the action, I can support this person and show some level of understanding and compassion. And the truth is what we have found, studies have found, that physician aid in dying, the primary motivation that people who have opted for this right under Jewish law, you know, many predicted that it would be depression. They thought people are depressed and that's why they're ending their lives. And when we look at surveys of those who are asked why they're making this decision, we have found that it's not because of depression. The number one reason is a sense of control. People understandably want to have a sense of control over their dying process. End of life, terminal illness, hospitalization includes so much being told what to do, being wheeled to places where you don't know where you're going, hearing medical language you don't understand. And to be able to have the ability to choose where and when and how it happens can be very comforting for people and give them that sense of control. And that's why I always argue as a chaplain that instead of trying to convince people that physician aid in dying is wrong, actually the most effective thing is to focus on eliciting and addressing the patient's own worries and apprehension, you know, about their healthcare and what they're going through and their future. And with the goal of trying to help them reduce their anxiety about the dying process and educate them about how their disease might progress and offering information and how to manage the pain and discomfort while maintaining you know, function and cognition and, you know, to listen, especially to listen and be there for them, just simply listen and show compassion. And actually we find that in many cases when that is done, people actually end up not doing it. In many, many cases, about 40% now in California, it used to be lower, but it used to be higher, but it's gone down a little bit. People who receive the drug, it's a drug that they ingest, that they swallow by mouth. Many, many people don't actually do it. They just want to have the option to do it. And so sometimes it's important to be able to hold within oneself the ability to support a person in that process. And it's a complicated process. Although there are other options people sometimes take, as we mentioned before, sometimes passive euthanasia is an option people will take where they'll say, I'm just going to allow things to run out, so to speak. And that's allowing the dying process and not engaging in life prolonging interventions. That's an option that's not really considered suicide in the same way, or something that's called VSED, voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. Sometimes people make that decision where they just kind of and use lots of pain medications. But that's something that people often choose. And so it's something just to be aware of, that this is legal here in California and it's something that is done with increasing frequency. It used to be that there was a 15-day waiting period between the first request and the second request before someone could do it. They had to have two requests from two different healthcare providers. That request time is now just 2 days. And we've seen a large increase in the numbers in California just in the last year of people utilizing this option. So I said a lot today. We covered a lot of topics, whether it was about ventilators and dialysis, withholding, withdrawing. I don't think I mentioned dialysis, but that was related when, just as we talked about with withholding and withdrawing. So to dialysis, as an example, something that's cyclical, that's only done once every couple of days, that's easier for the rabbis to allow stopping it because it's not withdrawing it. It's just saying, don't start the next cycle. So that's easier than just pulling the plug, so to speak, meaning withdrawing the extubating with taking out the ventilator. We talked about, so that's, you know, cyclical things or allowing the bag to run out. So we talked about ventilators, dialysis, timers, allowing things to run out. We talked about brain death, organ donation, living, posthumous, and truth telling, and now physician aid in dying. These are some important things to keep in mind. Lots of topics, but these are going to come up again next week as we actually fill out our advanced directives. But now let's hear your thoughts and your reaction. Many times, you know, I don't know why I'm called to the room, but a patient called me to the room and they say to me, Rabbi, I want to end my life, but I follow Jewish law and I'm first asking you, is it allowed? Now, obviously, my first response is not going to be yes or no. That's a trap, right? My first response is tell me more. Tell me about what you're going through. But let's say I do get pushed in the corner at a certain point. But is it allowed? I really do want to know. Is it allowed? So I will say it's not allowed. I'll find a way, you know, gently. And I have had experiences a number of times where people said to me without asking my opinion, they just said, I just want to tell you this. I know it's not allowed, or my rabbi said it's not allowed, but I want to tell you, if it was, I would do it. But the only thing holding me back is the fact that it's not allowed. My approach to that is like, well, let's see, what can we do to help you to your experience? Because obviously you're suffering a lot and you need someone to listen to you and to show compassion, and let's see how we can be there for you. But if you're just asking yes or no, is it allowed? Especially in a setting like this, we're in a kind of more academic setting, right? This is a discussion, a conversation, a class. If we're in a patient's room, it's obviously different. But just asking academically, yes or no? No, it's not allowed. What the discussion in the rabbis became, by the way, you should know, just because as an example of the compassion the rabbis showed, was that in the Talmud it says you cannot have burial rites even for someone who dies by suicide. They can't even be buried in a Jewish cemetery. But then the tradition developed that if they didn't die this is what I was hinting to before, if they didn't die by suicide as a result of rebellion against the tradition, which who does it for that reason? It is legitimate suffering and loneliness and isolation and existential suffering. If there is psychological reasons why they did this and not, you know, a sense of rebellion, so we always give them full burial rites and we treat them as if they died like anyone else. And so even after the fact, because it became a big issue, by the way, when aid in dying became legal in California, our first Orthodox patient, we've had Orthodox Jews who have done this and we never condemn them or criticize, you know, our first one who did this and the Chevra Kedisha was called, the patient had to go through a psychological evaluation. And they had to talk to people, and their family had told them this wasn't allowed by Jewish law. And they said, even though it's not allowed, I'm still doing it. And the Chevra Kedisha at first didn't want to bury them. They said, wait a second, are we allowed to? Are we allowed to bury them? Because how do we say they didn't know what they were doing when they had to go through a psychological evaluation twice? And so we were able to say, you know what? Obviously, if someone is suffering from a terminal illness and they're in the dying process, how could you not say that's suffering? Right? Of course they were suffering emotionally, existentially. And even though they knew what they were doing, they weren't doing it because of rebellion against religion. They were doing it because of their suffering, and we should only have compassion for them, and we should allow full burial rites, and that's what we did. Yeah. And we have time for one more. I see there is one.
How careful are people about interpreting these directives appropriately?
Yeah, you bring up a good question. It's a perfect conclusion and kind of segue to next week's conversation. Advanced directives are not perfect. Especially in the heat of the moment, in emergency crises, you can't expect them always to be followed. And it's very hard to predict the future. They're not perfect, but they're the best that we've got. And the great thing about advanced directives, and this is the great thing about all of you for being here for this conversation, and especially next week, what we're going to be experiencing, and hopefully what these last two sessions have really prepared us for, because that was the goal, was simply to bring up these issues to kind of prime us for the conversation next week. The best thing about advanced directives is the process of filling them out. because it encourages having difficult conversations that we usually avoid. And so having that conversation is a great gift, a gift to yourself, to your family, to your healthcare team, to your rabbis. It can, and I see it plenty working in a hospital, it can have an impact. You're right that there are situations in which it's either not followed or not known about or not followed properly. It can happen. It's not perfect. But it often does have a very big impact, very often. So it's a very important thing. We've developed an advanced directive that I think overcomes some of the common shortcomings. And so it kind of can get around some of those issues. And so I think it's a good advanced directive, even though it's not perfect. I think it's better than what else is out there. But most importantly, it causes people to talk about these issues. And these issues need to be talked about. I can't tell you how many times also in my experience as a chaplain, people said to me at the bedside of their dying loved one, you know, we never talked about this. I don't know what they would say about this or that issue. And so I wish I did. So this conversation is an opportunity to have that conversation that we're going to have next week. So I appreciate you bringing it up, and I appreciate you all being here, as I think it's been an important conversation. And next week it's going to get deeper even because we're really going to talk about ourselves next week. I appreciate that you brought that up, and I hope that you will join us again next week so that we can really dive in to that essential aspect of the advanced directive.